Welcome to Hallel Fellowship on the internet at hallel.info. Exodus 31 and 32 show us God as the master artist, the one who fills people with skill and imagination so they can build a tabernacle where he chooses to dwell among humanity. But the story quickly pivots to the golden calf, a human-created false representation of the divine. This calf is a sobering picture of what happens when we center our lives on something else than the one who made all things and is working to restore it. Then Moses intercedes for Israel, people who utterly disrespected their deliverer from slavery in Egypt. And we explore New Testament insights into the ultimate deliverer, the Messiah. We discover that repentance, mercy, and faithful obedience are what transform our hearts, even our communities, into a living dwelling place for God.
Exodus 31. God is introducing us he's assigning the various people that he has selected. Say, hey, I like this person, do this task when it comes to Eliav and for Judah as well as Bezalel. So we have these two gentlemen. For those of you who aren't artists, because I'm not an artist, okay. We've covered this before in the past. When it comes to art and making things in the form of for enjoyment, it's kind of like musicians are a type of artists, sculptors, painters, whatever. There's a lot of types of art that are out there. Clothing manufacturers are also artists in their own right as far as what they make and what they design. It is an interesting phenomenon that human beings have, and it's not exclusive to us, meaning that the other animals also display similar traits, in that when we want to do something, we just do it because it's fun, we enjoy it. It's just something we like to do. And when it comes to artists, are not immune to that process. They are actually probably the most susceptible, I think, of the people that I know, when it comes to wanting to do and enjoy what they make. So we have these tasks, which we just obviously went through in the case of Exodus, leading up to this, the different items. You have the altar of incense. You have the tapestries being made. All those things were all being made and being designed or being created or pictured, at least, to Moses by God, by all the various images or things he showed on the mountain. And so we have these lists. We're just going to get this list. We'll get to some of these items today. Maybe not a whole lot, but a few things. And the whole point is we have these artists who God has assigned to do this task. And those of you who have met artists or dealt with them in the past, they don't perceive their art as work. They perceive it as enjoyment, much like you would a conversation. So he's a conversationalist, likes to talk to people. Someone who likes to, go on walks, for example. That's their work. You're just enjoying it. You may do it for a living, but it's things you do for fun. So artists tend to associate their creation as if this is fun to do. And so they don't really associate it as necessarily work. However, it's important for us to understand that even though artists and others as well, all human beings, have been given gifts from God to use and to put them to use for the service of the people, it's also important to realize that God is an artist. He is a phenomenal artist. So look around us, look out the outside, the things he's created, the world, the stars, everything he's designing, our own bodies inside and out, all the cells, the whole works. He's an artist, not just an engineer or a scientist, actually truly an artist, which most engineers, scientists are artists too in their own right, as far as how to design things. But the idea of an artist, God knows that feeling. He knows that drive that's inside of us because he built it. So he points out, hey, everybody, you be working for me. And it seems honorable. Hey, you're doing great stuff for God. I mean, hey, what could be more honorable than that? I'm working for God. He should love this, right? That long-standing excuse. He's saying, no, it doesn't matter the fact that you feel this is for God. He's telling us, no, there are limits. We have limits regardless of what we think or feel. We're working for God, doing the Lord's work, yada, yada, all these excuses we rationalize ourselves with. But in reality, God's saying, I know that feeling. I know what that's like. And the answer still is no, you're going to rest. You're going to take time off. You're not going to actually work on Shabbat in order to make this system work. And I bring this up because I think it's funny in that contrast that to later on in our Torah when we have the Levites. And they actually have to work on Shabbat. I know, shockingly enough, it is. They work on holy days too. And so they're working on their tasks, even though it's Shabbat and holy days, because that's part of the actual Shabbat and part of the holy day cycle. So they're allowed to work on those tasks, on those things, events. But the individual artists who are making their tools for them and their various furnishings such cannot work on those Shabbat and holidays. So it's interesting dynamic going on here as far as how this whole scenario is kind of playing its way out, and that God has two different categories of people: those who are required to work on a Shabbat, in the case priests and such, and those who are prohibited from working on the Shabbat, everybody else. Okay, so it's kind of this interesting separation. So, and God separates it. God knows the feeling. He knows what we're thinking. He knows, it's nothing like we can argue that he's right or wrong. It's just how it is. So they have their artists, have their creativity. They have their workers who are also working for them too, who are not permitted to work, obviously. And the artists, of course, they themselves cannot work. So God is obviously an artist, and he also rested in the seventh day. So he's saying, hey guys, you can't have an excuse about not resting. I know that feeling. I did it myself. I know what it's like. I rested too. So you will also. So it's an important prohibition. And one of the fundamental ideas is that we don't seek our own pleasure. So when we look for Shabbat, right? What is Shabbat about? We understand the idea of resting and such and not working, but what do we do? At this point in time in our Torah portion, discussing Exodus, they don't really have a lot of tasks per se. There isn't a lot, an assigned place to go, the temple, the tabernacle, or things you have to go do yet, because it doesn't exist. So your relationship with God is pretty limited. So I'm going to discuss little things about that concept. We're going to conceptually talk about a few things that we're dealing with here on this, not just here in this passage, but throughout this whole section of Exodus through toward its tail end when we have the tabernacle built. So I want to point out a basic concept to us, which we sometimes forget, those of us who study Torah too closely. We sometimes forget this idea. As I'm going to write through the board here behind me, my string is a little bit wonky. That's right, my headset. So the temple, or also the tabernacle, which is the structure being built, the tabernacle. I'm going to write tab just because I can't spell tabernacle. So the temple tabernacle, the same project. What is the functionality of this structure? Now, we sometimes think, oh, well, what do we do with it? We offer things to it, right? We have the tabernacle. These artists are creating things such as the altar, both of them, altar, which is the animal one, as well as the incense one. So the incense, which was covered a little bit about us, the ingredients for the incense and oil and such was covered in Exodus 30, I think it was. So we cover these things. So these are things that they're created. They also have the menorah, right? We have the table. There's various other furniture products being built. I'm not going to write them all down because it's not really relevant to this discussion. But when we look at the temple that they've created, the tabernacle they've created, it's temples later, that's in Solomon's category, but the tabernacle itself. And these artists are creating, and all the various designs, the colors, the different fabrication of it, parts and such. When we look at the purpose behind these items, we can sometimes divide it up a little bit too finely. Now, which that's not wrong. That's fine. But we actually have other bigger pictures to think about too. We think of the items that God is having them make and why it's important to make them correctly, because they're going to be used. They're practically used items. They're really used things. But they also have an overall concept behind them. So sometimes those of us who study too much a little bit or go too deep into this concept in the tabernacle, we can get lost in some of this stuff. So for example, if I see the altar, if I had asked you the question, which I just started out with a minute ago, was what's a tabernacle or temple used for? What's its purpose? We tend, at least I tend, maybe you don't, but I tend to think about, well, what's its functionality? What does it do? Like, for example, I asked you, what's a car do, right? You could describe what a car does. You can describe what a dishwasher does. You define it by its function. That's how we tend to define things. It's pretty common. That's nothing wrong about it. But when we look at this temple that these guys are building, they're designing the building, we look at the altar, for example. Well, you have the altar for animal sacrifices, the altar for incense. We have the offerings being given for the animals. We have gifts, sins, that type of thing. We also have the incense, which is, we obviously have discussed before, prayers and the various incense formulas have different meanings behind them for the ingredients. But so we have functionality to it. And that's fine. And the menorah, we obviously the functionality for the light, table holds a showbread. We have these different things that have their purpose. But that's looking at the individual items. That's not why God built a tabernacle. It's not why these artists are building one to begin with. It has nothing to do with these items. These are just components of it. What did God say the purpose the tabernacle was? To dwell amongst them. That's its purpose. So when we look at the tabernacle as a whole, I'm going to erase some of these things so I can do a basic sketch of the tabernacle structure, which is covered more detailed in Numbers and such, which we won't get to today. It's not important. You have the tabernacle, you have the tribes over here, tribes over here, tribes over here, and tribes over there, right? And you have some of the priests are closer. I think they're on the east side. So we have, I'm going to try east, west, north, and south. We have the priests are hanging out. Moses and Aaron are hanging out right around here on the east side of the entrance. I think you have the Kohathites will hang out over here. I forgot where Gerari and the Maris, which side is which, it doesn't really matter. But otherwise, we can look at this and the whole point behind the imagery is that God's dwelling with inside the community of Israel, as the tribes are camping, doing their thing. So the artists are building this structure, the different parts to it. And the idea behind it is that God's dwelling amongst them. So the functionality of the tabernacle is to dwell with you, to God dwell with you. That's its function. You will recall that the quotation of the New Testament is that the sins, I mean the payment for sins, the for our transgressions and such recorded to us, were given to us by Moses because of our sins. These laws, these instructions about how to, this animal for that process, for this individual, this sin, that type of thing. Those are given to us because sin is amongst us. That's what we do. And God cannot dwell with us if that's our problem, that we have sin amongst us. So all those different features, the different components, the altars, the incense, the menorah, the table, all those things, those are all focused upon our relationship with God. But the whole goal for the artists to make is a place where God can dwell with inside of us. So there's a lot of people who've discussed this topic regarding the symbolism and the tearing down the different components of the tabernacle that these guys are building and its design and structure, all that stuff, and try to map it to a kind of human being as far as like our heart and our mind, our body, the different symbols from the metal posts being ribs. All these people who make these analogies and the similarities to a human being, which is fine. I'm not criticizing them at all. But the idea is they're trying to relate the concept that God is trying to dwell with us in our presence. Okay. And he's using artists to do it. I'm not saying those of us who aren't artists, myself included, I can't comprehend this. We can comprehend this, but the artist is what God is inspiring to build it the way that God wants it built. And this essentially, when you look at this whole picture, if I made a group, a community of Israel, big circle of community of Israel, God is in the middle of the center of the community of Israel. Well, the center part of a human being is not dimensionally or physically, but conception is in our emotional state. We tend to associate with our heart, our core being, our love of something. It's where our heart typically is. I'm not saying it physically is. I know some biologists, I'm sure, can figure this stuff out more than I can. But the idea is that our emotional state of being is in the middle of us. And so the idea is that God is in the middle of our emotional state of being. And where does art come from? Yeah, we say, well, it's our head. Not really. It's actually the feelings of the person who's developing the art. So we deal with artists, and God's inspiring artists. Consider the fact that he is the ultimate artist, and he is saying, as an art-inspired individual, a passion, an emotionally inspired individual is the dead center where God's at. That's where he wants that person to be. I've talked to my children this numerous times. I can't even think how many times now, that a human being uses logic for various tasks, right? But we use emotion for other tasks. And sometimes those of you who use logic more often than not, I'm more of a logic person, but I do sometimes, is that we tend to use our logic step by step by step to get us to a new location, a new revelation, a new idea, or a new conclusion. And that sounds great. But unfortunately, our logic also can drive us into places we don't actually want to be, and where we come to a conclusion we don't like, because we say, that doesn't sound right. Something's weird. This is put me in the wrong spot. This, something's off. Well, that's where we use our emotional concept, our spiritual idea of God, a spiritual relationship with God and with man in our heart, our emotions, say, hey, our logic did some rationalization steps and resulted in a conclusion that is inherently wrong. Okay. Let's go back and fix it. So our emotions used to fix some of our illogical missteps. So God, as you will know, in our Torah, covers over and over again the idea, for example, here's a non-logical example, right, that God uses. It's something called mercy. Now, mercy is not a logical thing. We have rules, we have regulations, we have consequences. That is logical sequence steps. Mercy steps out of the logic and says, okay, in spite of all that, we're to grant mercy to this individual and see what happens. See how they respond. Another concept is forgiveness. Same idea. Again, the rules will say there's no forgiveness. It's ridiculous. Why would you forgive? Here's the consequence for doing this action. Here's the penalty. Move on. Next case. With forgiveness, okay, in spite of all that, we're going to forgive this person and let them to continue on and see what happens. We're like an experimentation type thing. Forgiveness and mercy are super, super critical to God and to Messiah too. He talks about this a number of times. If you don't have forgiveness, you don't have mercy, you don't get it. So God is really big on these concepts. Yes, we have our Torah, we have our instructions, but the mercy and forgiveness is a big thing. That is an emotional, spiritual idea that's not a logical sequence. Logical sequence, there's no room for that, there's no space for that. So we know our God is driven or drives it with inside of us the non-logic sequence of stepping outside of the law, stepping outside of the rules, and go into, where does the mercy and forgiveness apply? Where does love apply in spite of the fact that so-and-so didn't deserve it, right? Because they did X, Y, Z, some problem or some issue you have. So artists have, in my mind, seem to have a special place in God's world, God's realm, because their logic is not their primary tool. Their understanding and perception is their primary tool. And perception, or perceiving something beyond logical sequences, that's the tools they typically use. Not exclusive. I'm not saying they're just one thing only, but that's the primary tool they develop. So when God's saying, I want to inspire people to do something, this isn't a logical inspiration. This is an emotional or spiritual inspiration. It's outside of our logical sequence steps. So essentially, what I, Daniel Age's opinion, I tie it into, he's tying into their heart. The heart, the drive of the person, the heart behind them. That's my opinion. That's my words, not God's words. So him being the center of this visual, this picture, pictorial thing we have, this imagery of God being in the middle of us, and the idea that the tabernacle's function is to be the middle of the people so God can dwell within us. The other features, the altar, the incense altar, as well as the menorah, the table, the outfit the priest wears, All those things, those are decorative and they're beautiful. They have their meanings, they have their functionality, but they're not the reason the tabernacle exists. The reason it exists is because God can dwell with us. That's why it exists. So he can be with us. It's not a sin mitigation tool. It's not designed to mitigate your sins. Oh, let's fix the sins. Let's fix it. That's not its function. Yeah, it can do that, but that's not its primary function. It's to dwell with us tool. It's God's way of dwelling with us and hanging out with us, saying, hey, I like to be in your presence. I want to get to know you. Who are you? What are you made of? What makes you tick? What makes you think? And get to know who we are. That's the tool, its function. The sin mitigation is the fact that he doesn't want to accidentally kill us unintentionally because we did something we should have done. He can't be around sin. It just doesn't work. So it's a function. The sin mitigation portion of it, a small portion, is to address what the equipment does, the furniture does. But its purpose is to God to dwell with us. That's its purpose. That's its drive. That's God's main function is. Hopefully it makes sense so far. If I lose you, I apologize, but I'm trying to conceptually get the idea behind what this tabernacle is for. So then we go into this tabernacle. So we have the artists who were inspired to build these parts, these pieces, these components. And Moses, of course, up there in the mountain this whole time, 40 days, whatever it was, the mountain for this whole time. And he's up there. Then God says, hey, because the golden calf, problem occurs. So we have this golden calf incident. This is also an artist. Okay, so Aaron, I'm not sure how good of an artist he was, but that this is how he is. So the artists also have this golden calf scenario. So we know what God's purpose is to dwell with the inside of us. Now we have this cow. It was on the outside. I don't draw real well, so forgive me. So my cow looks like, a stick figure dog, sort of. Tail and big head and horns. Okay, so we have a cow that's on the outside. The cow does not belong inside the community of Israel. It doesn't belong there. It's even though an artist made it, that's fine. Don't make fun of my cow. Come on. The artist made it, but she's still making fun of it. Even though an artist makes it, that doesn't necessarily, everything an artist is inspired to do is necessarily godly, okay? So this is Aaron's thing. I'm not saying he's responsible for the calf in whole, but he is most responsible for the calf because it could come out like, he didn't come out and make a gold plate. He made an animal. So this golden calf thing, and they've done their worshiping, and he makes this, he forms this gold into this with smith's tools, and he fashions this calf out of gold earrings. So I think it's a fascinating contrast to where God is designing a system, a tabernacle by the artists to be with inside of Israel's heart. And while Moses is up on the mountain, instead of God's tabernacle, this big rectangular shaped, building. So this tabernacle being there, the children of Israel insert this stick calf that Daniel builds with horns. Okay. They put a stick calf or a golden calf stuck inside right where God says, this is my spot. This is where I live. This is my location. You're booting me out and putting a golden thing there that's not even representative of me, and it's claiming that that's me. So this you can kind of, I can, maybe you can't. I can see the emotional frustration God would have over this problem. He's spending all this time with Moses describing the altar and the incense, and the fabric and the sockets and everything else going on there. And they're busy saying, okay, God, while you're out, I want to push you, God, out there on the basically swapping places. Because as you notice, says that we don't look happen as Moses, right? So they point out, I'm going to draw this a terrible mountain. So Moses on top of a mountain, I'll put him a stick figure up here. He's a mountain with this God cloud going around up there. Essentially, he's on the outside. So they're on the outside, God and Moses on the outside, and Israel, the people say, let's insert a calf in the middle of us instead. Isn't that a great idea? Right. No, exactly. No, it's not. So in spite of the fact that God's having these artists make things and try to make the design them for him to dwell within the people, instead the people insert this calf. Now, if you're, again, visual picture here, you're God and you're Moses, you're hanging out with God on the outside. And Joshua's here too. We'll give him, I don't know where he's in the mountain. I'm assuming he's somewhere down halfway. I'm just making an arbitrary location for Joshua's hanging out there too, somewhere. Anyway, so Moses the mountain, God's the mountain, they're all now outside of Israel's, the people group, the body of Israel. I realize they're not camped like this yet, mind you. The Israelite camps are just kind of all scattered, I'm sure. I don't know what it looks like. It doesn't matter. The point is, when God is trying to design a place for to dwell within them, instead, he is put on the outside and a calf is put in the middle instead. Like they swapped places with him. Yes, Yosef. What's your question? Okay, there's a common question he asked. Yosef asked, if Joshua was hanging that mountain too with Moses, did he not eat for 40 days and 40 nights? Honestly, I don't know. It doesn't say. Apparently Joshua did not know what was happening in the camp, because when Moses comes down the mountain, he says, hey, there's war in the camp. And Moses, that isn't war. That's partying. That's a party, Joshua. He's like, oh, so he's surprised. So apparently Joshua didn't get the memo that what was happening in the camp. I assume he wasn't making daily trips. If he did, he probably would have known, but I don't know. So I can't answer the question. I assume either he had lots of provisions or God was feeding him too. I don't know. I don't know what's happened to Joshua. It's unclear to me what he was eating. Anyway, so this calf, inspired by not the same artists in particular necessarily, they may have been a part of it, who knows, but it was inspired by the people themselves. They wanted a different heart in them, a different emotional, spiritual relationship was within them. That's what they wanted, not what God was trying to build. And this is where the disconnect occurs. When we have a God, we have God tries to build a relationship with us as individuals, not just community, but as individuals too. Community also, it's kind of a blend of both, but we're both individuals and we are a community. So when God's building a relationship with us, this is not unlike the struggle he has with every one of us in one way or another, right? We have our preconceived idols that we have built in within our hearts and our minds and our souls, and what we want, what we think we want at least, what we worship, we're designed to worship things. So God has put within us the ability to select what we want to worship or honor or lift up. And we choose what that is. We get to choose. So the people themselves, as instance, this imagery we have, they've chosen a calf, but they're meaning a non-God thing, but claiming it's godly, claiming it's like God. It's just like God. It's just equivalent to God. I don't usually use this analogy very often, but it's still conceptually true. You may have noticed the humanist viewpoints, right? The humanist concept. I'm not saying human beings, but the religion of humanism, in that the idea is that I as a human being, or humanity as a whole, or human beings, or life, whatever you use a term, is somehow equivalent to God. It's equivalent to be worshipped, to being honored, and being lifted up and raised above all of us. How great life is, how great wisdom is, or knowledge, or whatever you want to call it, is a humanist religion. So that's another example of this exact same thing, golden calf. It has the elements or pieces or parts of God in it, but it doesn't really have God. It just has like attributes that we extracted from our Father, fractured from God, and inserted into this thing. So the idea of humanism, that humanity is somehow great, or which it is, I'm not saying it's not great, but it has some greater purpose for itself to be itself and to lift itself up and to dominate and take control and whatever it's going to do. I'm not really an expert on humanism, but the idea is that even from our modern day religion, which is humanism or scientism, but music humanism, is that it's the same idea as we've taken God out, inserted something else. It doesn't have to be a golden calf. I can make this calf into a big letter H and now it's a humanism, right? Now it's a humanism. Okay. I can make it into anything I want. It doesn't make a difference. So the idea is that we as people are going to insert something into us in the center of who we are. Whatever that something is, that's what we're going to do. Whether it could be family, your own personal family, for example, or it could be a loved one. You could, it's be the center of your world, right? But that person dies, and then where are you at? You're empty. Whatever you as a human centers or puts in the center of your universe, your center of your world, your existence, your being, that's where God says, I belong there, not someone or something else. So if I choose as a human being to put something else here other than God, what have I done? I've made an idol. I've made a new God of whatever it is, whatever I choose to worship, whatever I choose to honor, I've made that. So God has assigned artists to make a place that he can dwell with inside you. And artists typically use a different set of skills than those of us who strictly use logic to do stuff. I'm not strictly logic, by the way. I have a heart too. But as far as it's not my expertise, is not that strong when it comes to art skills. As you can see with my golden calf sketches. So art's not my forte. But we're going to put something here as a human being. Now we also, as a community, will do the exact same thing. Not just individuals, but people do this as a whole, as a body of people. We do the same thing. And it doesn't matter what that happens to be. We can insert anything. It can be laws. A society of laws, for example, you can worship and honor law or whatever you wish to be. We have millions of laws in the United States. You can worship any one of them. I'll light them up. You can worship ideas. Like an idea or a concept or a belief in something or some want or desire. And obviously the most common one, which our forefathers warned against when they established the United States, was, of course, money. That can also be the center of your world, too. These are not exclusive. There are other options. You can do other things there, too. It doesn't have to be these ideas or concepts. We could be anything inserted. But the point is that we're going to insert something there as a community, okay? Not just as individuals. So we have a responsibility for God to try to insert God into this space, both as individuals, but also as a community as a whole. Those of you who have been paying attention the past couple hundred years, not that you're that old, but for at least a couple hundred years in the United States, God has been slowly, in some cases faster than others, depending on which decade you're talking about, been being pushed out of our community, the center of our community. Has been about each other or a bit about a common goal or a common desire of something, as opposed to God being the center. And it's not saying all those common goals are evil. They're not all evil. Some common goals are good. But just because a common goal is good, the only good that came out of it was the fact that we extracted something from God or Torah to begin with to make something good about it. So we as a community can do the exact same thing. We can insert within our hearts so that we desire as a people, as a community, as a whole, that God says, this is not me. It's not what I asked for, not what I recommended. I can't dwell, God saying, not me personally, not Daniel, but God. God can't dwell within a community if he's been pushed outside and replaced. So hopefully this makes sense so far. I wouldn't lose anybody. We can insert anything in here. But God's goal was a tabernacle. So as we go to chapter 32, in this idea, they go to Aaron and say, "Hey, I need gold." Aaron says, "I need gold, earrings, rings, whatever, to make a golden calf." Gold itself is not evil. Yeah, human beings desire it. We attach to it, but it's not an evil thing. God made it. It's just metal. It has its various properties. But just because something is used for an evil concept or evil task, doesn't mean the item itself is inherently evil. We have lots of things that humanity has turned into bad things from the great one, rainbows. That's a good one. Rainbows. Rainbows are not evil, but yet what are they turned into in the gay or lesbian community has turned a symbol of their community as being evil. I'm not saying that all of them are evil human beings, but the action, the advocacy of is evil. So just because God makes something and human beings insert it, so we can put a rainbow there too. I don't have multiple colors, but we'll have a little rainbow here. Right? we communicate, we take a center of piece of God that God made, which is beautiful or lovely or good, and we insert it where it becomes an idol. So even the rainbow doesn't have a face or ears or eyes or nose. The idols that we traditionally associate with our Bible is saying idols, but it is a symbol of something, which is a symbol of wickedness in this instance, or the symbol of the advocacy of wickedness. So we have this struggle with humanity. We take God's things and tend to move them into areas, into our hearts, our minds, and reassign them a thing to worship or work toward or honor or lift up higher than it belongs, basically become a symbol of something that was not necessarily good. The rainbow itself isn't evil, as you guys have all seen lots and lots and lots of rainbows. So that makes sense so far. So I hope I don't want to lose anybody on this idea that God is using artists to develop a place for him to dwell within side of our, not just our community, but also our hearts, our minds, our individuals, human beings. Because the goal for God is to dwell here. And Aaron's priests over here, all different, you know, priests and such on the sides. Our goal, his objective of the tabernacle is to put him in the middle. Yes, it has things, furniture, but those furniture items are not sin mitigation tools. They are just, the purpose of the tabernacle is not. Some of them can be used for that, but it's a small portion of their functionality. God dwelling in you is the purpose of the tabernacle. That's its function. You will note that in our New Testament authors, which cover this topic in different ways, they discuss the idea of the people being like, for example, Peter, living stones, right? That in 1 Peter 2, it talks about that people themselves, Peter's discussing this, that they are living stones, which is more of an association, of course, with the temple as with the tabernacle, which temples is Solomon's thing. But the idea is that those stones are part of who you are, and we are a contributor to the community or the temple of God in the case of King Solomon. And obviously Paul does in Corinthians a couple of different spots talk about, you know, the human being, our body, and the temple of God being dwelled. It would be the same thing, and that God wants to dwell within inside of us. So these symbols are pretty standard symbols within Judaism as well as in Christianity too. So there's nothing abnormal here. And Jesus, of course, reiterates the same thing. He points out, hey, your body, his body is a temple. You kill it off and raise it 3 days. He used the same imagery within inside this. And for those of you who recall, one chapter ago, one chapter ago when they did the census, even the census with the half shekel census and such, it was silver half shekels. I don't remember the weights, like, so a certain number of grams. It's like if we're like 13 to 16 grams. It's whatever what the weight is, the main difference. But they had the half shekels they were giving to count the shekels instead of the people, the heads and such. You remember that those half shekels were melted down and made as the socket bases for the sticks, the posts, the golden posts that are put around the entire tabernacle. Imagine those had dots around here. Of this structure. I forgot how many there are. I forgot the number, but a whole bunch of them. So those silver items, silver that they half shekels were donated by the people. So they were used for counting the people, right? Recall that. And when they use to count the people, God then essentially takes those counts, those head counts. I think this is beautiful. Takes those head counts of all those people, melts them down, which purifies them, by the way, because you melt down silver, you make it really hot, purifies them, and then puts it as the foundation of the tabernacle. That's beautiful to me. All right, so he's saying, hey, everybody, not only is the tabernacle which I'm going to dwell in, I'm going to count you as individuals as its foundation that makes this thing stand upright, which is cool too. So in the same conceptual idea that our New Testament authors are discussing is that the parts, the pieces, the tabernacle itself is all made up of people. We are God's temple, another way of wording it. As a community, not just as human beings, but as a community we are. So as a community, if we're supposed to be the foundation here of this tabernacle, and we say, I like the golden calf instead, you know, sayonara, you know, tabernacle, essentially you erased yourself. you put a cow here with horns and tail. Oh, that was a terrible cow. Okay. Horns and tail. You got rid of your own foundation. You took yourself out of God's tabernacle because you're counted in it. You're its foundation. You're its base. You're the beginning of it. So it's not only a rejection of God, it's actually as a community rejects you. It rejects the individuals. So the whole process is a serious like affront to your entire existence as a person in God's world, because he didn't just make it to where it's for him to dwell. He made it to where the building itself, the base structure that holds it all together is you. You're the base structure. You're the thing that holds it together. Imagine, here's another example. You can conceptually think of this. Imagine a single congregation. Halal Fellowship is a good example. It has people that show up to me. Imagine no one showed up. No one was there. Never, ever. What happened? It wouldn't exist. Okay, there was nothing there. There's nothing to have. So it's not hard to realize that, hey, as a community, we are part of God's family. We're part of its identity. We're part of making God stand as a community with inside us as a team effort. So it's not a strange idea that our New Testament authors are accentuating the same concept, this temple tabernacle thing. So I'll move on to the next topic of discussion. I wouldn't lose anybody so far. Mediators. Okay, so we have an interesting dynamic. I'm going to erase this off my board because zoom in detail view of this mountain. Okay, we redraw the mountain up here. So we have a mediator scenario going on here as well. So I realize Mount Sinai does not look like this peak. So forgive me, but I don't know. I'm not a very good artist. So Moses is hanging out here. Right? And he has this cloud, this dark cloud with lightning strike that comes out of it. And you've got a Joshua somewhere midway up. I don't know where he's at. And a bunch of people down here, right? I'm not going to discuss all their actions, what they do yet, but there's people on the ground because they're not part of this scenario with Moses and God. So Moses is receiving these commandments, his instructions, as well as obviously the imagery, the picture of what's happening, what the temple is supposed to look like. And God's saying, hey, we have a problem. We got to go take care of Moses. These people you brought out, as if it's like it's Moses' fault. These people you brought out, I can't handle them. We got to get rid of them. And they're all going to hell in a handbasket. He didn't use that term, but he kind of would have put them there because he would have killed them all off. So God's solution was that light from the, hey, will you close the curtain there? It messes some lights up here. Thank you. So God's solution for this scenario is to kill them off. Okay. Again, as I mentioned before, when we started out here with the whole artist and the idea of law and logic compared to mercy and forgiveness, in the case of this scenario, the people had already agreed multiple times leading up to this point that whatever you God say, we will do. It's repeated like Exodus, I think it's 25 and 20. And they repeat a whole bunch of times. They say it over and over and over and over again. They're agreeing to the Ten Commandments and even some of the details behind them. So the chapters that immediately followed Exodus 20 discuss like some of the details about what does it mean to have one God? What does it mean to not murder? What does it mean to not steal? It has some basic examples what those are. And they all said, yep, we get it. We got it. We're on the same page, God, with you. We're all happy. Yay, gung-ho. Go for it, right? So they made their agreement already. They already said, yes, we will do this. Not a problem. We agree. A month and a few days later, they say, okay, we change our mind. We're going to do something else. We have our golden calf. We're going to build. I'll draw my terrible calf. Okay, I'm going to be impatient. My terrible calf inside. So they make a golden calf instead, and because they're done with God. Well, and God tells Moses, okay, I'm going to kill these people off. Clearly, they are completely non-trustworthy, which you could get for that. If it puts yourself in God's shoes. You give somebody a contract, we say, okay, you read the terms, I read the terms, we agree to it, we reiterate the contract after we agree, let's clarify some details, yep, we still agree, we're all on the same page, you have these agreements. This is all legit. Both parties sign. We're all said and done. We say, yep, we're a good pay. High-fiving. We're all high-fiving the hallways. We're all doing good, right? That's the idea. And then all of a sudden they say, I'm turning my back this way. By God. And hang off, right? Well, from a legal standpoint, they broke the contract. Like totally, totally broke it. In every way you can think of. Okay? They broke it. Broke it royally. Like big time. This isn't like an accidental thing. This is a major break. So in this contract problem, in a law state of things, there is no purpose for forgiveness and mercy. What is that? God's pointing out, hey, they broke the rules. All right, kill them all off. We're done. End of story. Moses will start over again. We'll give these people, I assume God would have spared Joshua because he wasn't part of it, but we'll give it to these people and Moses will start over with you. We're good. That's interesting because God spends a fair amount of the Torah and as well as the prophets and even the New Testament, of course, more completely, but still the same principle about mercy and forgiveness. And here was an example of our God, at least not initially, showing a merciful aspect, a merciful component of it, right? What gives? What's going on here? Well, I realize the Torah is not written yet because we're just going through this part of the storyline. There's still an Exodus. They're still kind of working their way to get the rest of the details. But our God is still our God. Just because he didn't write all the rules down yet for us to read, his heart, his mind didn't change. He still has the same mercy and forgiveness he always had. He would start out that way, right? That's who he is. So this is not, this seems, from what we understand of God, a little bit out of character. Well, that seems like a really harsh all of a sudden. I realize their corruption of themselves was extreme. It was really bad. This is a bad thing. But at the same time, okay, God, kill them all off. Well, there's going to be a few people who weren't that bad, and they at least handpick them out. Some, a couple, two or three, somebody else to spare. Right? Maybe not all, but maybe a few. And God says, nope, kill them off. And then we have the example of Moses saying, hey, hold it, wait, stop. Let's talk about this God and let's intercede. So Moses essentially becomes an intercessor for us. Not just the people there at that time, the intercessor, obviously we were there at the time, but the people of Israel at the day, he was an intercessor for them. He becomes a mediator between God and them, right? And we've talked about this in the past, both the whole fellowship and many churches have. This is not a new thing. Synagogues are the same exact concept in that the idea of advocating for life is still super, super important, even though it's not deserved. That makes sense. A person may fail. They may make mistakes of any form, any sin, any transgression. They can make them, and we do make them, both from a physical sense, emotional sense, a spiritual sense. We make mistakes, and that's going to happen to all of us. There aren't really exceptions here. We're not going to discuss, Jesus per se, but the majority of us is not really an exception. Okay, so the mistakes are going to happen along the way, right? And the idea being, well, we talked about earlier about the logic sequences. Here's your mistake. Here's a penalty. Pay the penalty. Moving on. Next case. The merciful part is that here's a mistake, here's a penalty. I'm going to commute, I'm going to alter, I'm going to soften the penalty. It's not full extreme because there is remorse, there's repentance going, there's a heart behind this person. And this heart means something to God. And Moses is demonstrating that hey, God, mercy is who you are. It applies here too. Now, we can look at like God was like, oh, Moses, I didn't realize. Thank you so much for pointing that out to me. Oh, I was mistaken. I was wrong. You're right, Moses. Oh, I'm such a fool. No, that's ridiculous. This is an example to us about Moses. God's not dumb. He knows these people. He knew them beforehand. He knew they're from Egypt. This isn't shocking. It was like, oh my goodness, I had no idea these people were going to do this. What a horrible thing. I'm shocked. I'm disappointed. maybe disappointed, but not shocked. Okay, this is not crazy, like out of the blue, never even saw this coming. It's pretty darn simple, obvious. They came from a heavily pagan culture who worshipped idols. This is not shocking and weird. So for God to not realize what's going to happen would be absurd. God's smarter than this. And Moses realizing, hey, yeah, they're dumb, okay? I'm using the tongue in cheek, but they make their mistakes. But the point is, we can forgive mistakes as long as the people realize they make a mistake and then change behavior. Back to a previous diagram I had with the whole, the camps hanging around the tabernacle, which we'll discuss more with numbers, and this imagery. Just because I temporarily, I don't know how many weeks it was, days, how I don't remember how long it was. Maybe it was overnight. I'm not sure. I temporarily put a calf here. Doesn't mean I have to leave the calf there. I had to say, oops, error, my mistake. I'll put God back. Right? I had that ability as a human being. Right? If we have the ability to say, oops, a mistake, moving it back, let's fix this. That's honorable. That's a blessing. That's a good thing. That's where forgiveness and mercy, that's its core of saying, hey, I made a mistake. I'm going to move back and correct it. I can't undo. I can't make it not happen, but I can at least try to repay for it as best I can and improve along the way. So Moses points out as a mediator, intercessor, hey, God, don't just kill them all off. We're going to demonstrate or talk to them and deal with these people. And by the way, Moses does kill a whole bunch of them. Not all, but a fair amount of them he does kill off. The Levites help him out in this process. So he does this. That's the following, subsequent, storyline. So Moses is interceding on our behalf. So even though we made this mistake, put a golden calf there temporarily, or in your personal life as an individual today, because we're not back there at that time, you temporarily had a lapse of judgment and made a mistake. Whether you replace God with self-pleasure for a little while, or replace God with some other vice, alcohol, drug, anything, whatever you want to put in there, instead you replace it temporarily. I get it. And it may be that temporary, I use that term loosely, it may not be that temporary. It could last years. The point is, you still did it, but you have the ability to say, I'm going to pull that temporary idol out and reinsert God into it, right? That temporary idol, as we learn from Ezekiel 18, once you do that, God's like, I'm cool with you. You're cool with me. I'd say like, whatever you did before, like it never happened. The golden calf, gone. Never saw it. Don't know what it is. Golden who? And in the form of God saying, if you can do this as a person, if you're willing to do this, the golden calf becomes, nothing more than a historical footnote, irrelevant in your life, or your personal vices that you've personally experienced as a community or as an individual, as a family. If you're able to say, I'm putting God back where he belongs, then God's like, yep, we're good with you. We're all happy that a past history didn't happen. We're done. Like it never occurred. We're moving on. So that's a good blessing. But what does it require? For God to say we're moving on, he can't make it not happen, if that makes sense. He can't make it like as if it never, and if he can't truly make it like the history never occurred. It did occur. So something has to intervene or say, okay, we're covering this expense, which when Jesus comes in to hold the whole propitiation, that's the right word, for our sins. That is the point of who takes the place of it. So we can fix these things, this golden calf problem and moving into God bringing it back. And Moses is giving us the example, say, hey, God, don't kill him off yet. We can address this. We can see where the remorse is and bring this back where it belongs. And of course, this whole process takes place. I won't go to all of it as far as the evil that God was going to kill them all off. This is verse 12 of 32. And it says, discuss the details about how that was going to be and God was going to, take them all out. Moses winds up, of course, doing this stuff. He cracked the tablets and all the commandments that God did and wrote down. And of course, that's its own additional component of intercessors. But we're a little about this, spent a little bit of time, not a lot. Let's jump to our New Testament, not the portion we read, but a different section we'll cover a little bit. In the case, I'm going to jump a little bit to the idea of mediators. So We've talked about this in the past regarding Abraham, Sodom and Gomorrah, a mediator, a good mediator example. Says, hey, I'm going to stand in the way and try to discuss this with God and whittle them down to 10 choices. Before we get to New Testament examples in Timothy and Hebrews and John, there's one more thing that Moses also does more explicitly. We'll hit there real quick before we go to our New Testament discussions. Go to Deuteronomy 9, because that's an example where Moses reiterates in a little detail about his mediation process. So he even points out with Deuteronomy 9, jumping down to the whole chapter talks about Israel's rebellion, right? The nature of their natural tendency to rebel. But the whole time we're cover the whole thing. But in this golden calf thing specifically, jump down to verse 13. Yeah. Well, so Moses is restating the golden calf problem to them in this farewell address in Deuteronomy. So verse 13 says, furthermore, the Lord spoke to me saying, I have seen this people. Indeed, they're a stiff-necked people. Verse 14 of Deuteronomy 9. And let me alone, that I may destroy them, blot them out the name from the heavens. I will make you a nation mightier and greater than they. So I, Moses, turned and came down the mountain. The mountains burned with fire. The two tablets of the covenant were at my hands. I looked, and there you had sinned against the Lord your God, and had made yourselves a molten calf. You had turned aside quickly from the way which the Lord commanded you. Then I took the two tablets and threw them down out of my hands, broke them before your eyes. We'll pause for a minute. So for those of you who don't have a good visual, which sometimes we do, sometimes we don't, on the Ten Commandments, I'm going to draw a real quick sketch up here. So this is an important concept. For those of you who think more construction-like, lack of a better term to word it, where you build a house from foundation up, right? That the idea that you start with the foundation, you stick the walls, and it builds up, right? Well, the commandments of the tabernacle, the commandments are inverted, the exact opposite of that. So I'll do a quick minor sketch. I'll put it over here on this side. So imagine you have hooks. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And each hook is from the top is hanging off this bar. The bar is God, okay? The bar is a big beam, like a beam in a ceiling, okay? The bar is God. The Ten Commandments are 10 categories of laws, right? We have, for example, here's an easy one that you can all easily visualize. The idea of thou shalt not murder, okay? I forget which number it is, but it's somewhere down here. It's toward the tail end. So we'd like, 1 through 10, the end. And, so down here, the murdering thing, the thieving, and the adultery, and the coveting, all the stuff. Well, later on in our Tanakh and our Torah, it gives examples of what is and what isn't murder, right? In Exodus earlier, I think 22, I think it was, discussed a little about slavery, for example, too, which has a Shabbat component to it. So we have laws that come off and be categorized into these 10 categories. Now, some laws like are two, there's more than one category shoved together in a particular scenario or law. So which is some things are that way. But as Jesus had used the analogy that the law, the prophet, they hang on these 10 commandments. They're dependent upon, they hang on them. They're being held up by the category of 10 commandments. So we think of 10 commandments, we think of the two tablets, which is fine. But the idea is that all the laws of God hang on them like a chandelier would hang. All the laws. So if you break the chandelier's beam, what happens? Every law is shattered down, right? That's the idea. All of them crush. And so you can't break one of them without all of them being failed, because everything behind it downstream fails. So if I break the law of adultery, all the laws of adultery, I crash down the ground, shout on the ground, and make a glass mess of a chandelier type of thing. So if I break the law of honoring one God, all the laws about God come shouting down a big mess. Hence why the apostles point out, you break one, you broke them all. it doesn't make a difference. So you make one commandment, you broke all of them because they're all hanging. It's a visual of a hanging concept, not a built up concept like we tend to do in a Western culture. So that's the idea of it. So when Moses comes along and breaks the commandments, we think he threw the tablets down, which is literally true what he did. But conceptually speaking, it's like taking this beam and cracking it right in the middle. And if you've had a beam holding up anything, you're breaking it, what happens to all the stuff of the beam? Whoa, crunch. Okay, so they all break. You break one, you break them all. So this is the idea, that's the idea of this. It's not a foreign concept, but it's a good visual for my mind. It helps me keep things clear about when it comes to commandments and laws and how God views them more of a hanging structure like a tree as opposed to some foundational, like foundation of a house. It's just done differently. Anyhow, so Moses breaks 10 commandments, shatters the ground, because the people themselves shattered their identity with God. Their relationship with God's broken. The being that held all these commandments up, the instructions they all agreed to. It's like taking covenant and just ripped it apart, or take contract or burned it or shredded it. The whole ending contract is now garbage. It's all useless. Even though I only broke one part of it, I broke the whole contract. It's all done. So this idea is not strange. So continue on. So he broke the commandments. Where was it? Mountain, quickly. Verse 18 of Deuteronomy 9. And I fell down before the Lord as the first 40 days, 40 nights, neither ate bread nor drank water, because all your sin which you committed in doing wickedly in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. For I was afraid of the anger and hot displeasure with which the Lord was angry with you and to destroy you. But the Lord listened to me at that time also. And the Lord was very angry with Aaron and would have destroyed him. So I prayed for Aaron also at that same time. Then I took your sin, the calf which you had made, and burned the fire, crushed it and ground it very small till it was fine as dust, threw it in the dust in the brook, to the mountain. And of course, it goes on to discuss other things which Moses did. So the idea is that Moses spent his effort to intervene, the intercessor, the mediator between you and God, or the Israelites and God. That's an important role that we were able to see about this process, about this character of Moses playing this role of not just dealing with the golden calf people themselves, but also Aaron, who created it, the artist. He's not the artist that God sent to the tabernacle, but he still clearly has some kind of art skill because he can create a golden calf. I can't do that, but he can. So you have his better skill than I've got as far as artistic skills, that is. So Moses is the intercessor in this case. So essentially Moses saying, yes, they did put a golden calf here. As a community, they did. And also as individuals, they did. So they put a golden calf as a community. Also, Aaron did, right? As a man, right? And God's saying, not only did the community do that, Aaron did it. As a person, he put the golden calf there. Now, Aaron made this lame excuse, gold threw in, calf popped out. Okay, that was pretty pathetic. But anyway, he said anyway. So he's trying to cover his rear end, okay? Because he knows he's in hot water. So anyway, so Aaron did this, and he. I know Judaism argues they probably would have killed him had he said no. Maybe it's true. Maybe they would have killed him if he had said no. I don't know. I wasn't there. But even if that's the case, at least he'd have God with him in the middle. At least God was still the center. But these guys were pretty young, not age-wise, but young spiritually-wise. They were young and not realizing the extent of the severity of what they did. So even though they broke three commandments. Anyway, they broke a few commandments. They didn't break every one of them, but just a few. You could argue how many. We can debate that. But essentially, all of them get broken because the penalty is the same. Does it matter if I hit a brick wall at 5,000 miles an hour or 4,000 miles an hour? What's going to happen to my body? It's the same result, okay? It's just because you didn't do it as severe as possible, you still did it. So the end result's essentially the same. So the idea, but the intercessor is the important part. So even though God was essentially what I, Daniel Age's opinion, by the way, I think God was essentially testing Moses and saying, okay, Moses, what are you made of? Are you like Abraham? Do you have it in you to say, okay, I'm going to intervene, even though I didn't do anything wrong. It's not my fault. I'm going to intervene anyway. Is that within you, Moses, or not? And God found out that absolutely, it totally is, which is perfect. That gives us our Messiah's role so that when Jesus comes along, he can mimic the storyline, not this exact event, but the idea is that the cons behind it. So our New Testament authors cover that more thoroughly, this intercessor concept. We have, let's jump to, I'm going to all of them. Let's do to First John. I like First John's version the best. So First John, he's got a smaller book. Okay. So First John chapter 2. This is my preference of it. I just happen to like the way John wrote this. It's not that it's better or worse. I just happen to like his wording. So in First John 2, it points out, this is John speaking. My little children, he's an old man, by the way. He can get away with that, little children. He's an old man when he wrote this. My little children, these things I write to you that you may not sin. And if anyone sins, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus the Christ, the righteous. And he himself is the propitiation, that's that big word, propitiation for sins, for our sins, and not for ours only, but also for the whole world. Now, by this we know that we know him if we keep his commandments. He who says, I know him and does not keep his commandments is a liar, and the truth is not in him. But whoever keeps his word, truly the love of God is perfected in him. By this we know that we are in him. He who says he abides in him ought himself to walk just as he walked. So, the commandments of Jesus reiterated was the same ones Moses gave. It's all the same thing. Matthew 5 is pretty darn simple. You do the same thing that Moses said. So all commandments Jesus gave, essentially the same commandments Moses had. It's all the same stuff. So John's saying, hey, okay, I'm going to replace names here now. We're now talking Moses the mountain. We're talking about Jesus now up in heaven. Okay, so it's not Moses the mountain now. We're inserting name, insert Jesus on heaven. Okay, so Jesus in heaven, he's talking to God up there. I don't know what they're doing. They talk. So I'm up there. And he's pointing out that, hey, just like Moses came down and said, hey, you guys got to clean your act up. I'm going to get rid of this gold dust. You drink it, whatever, make it go away. And a few people die in the process. Don't get me wrong. People die in this process. And he goes back up and he intercedes. Well, same thing. Jesus is the exact same principle. He's here on earth saying, hey, everybody, you know, do what God told you to do. Do what Moses gave you. And anyone who teaches or does not do or teaches anyone to do less will be least the kingdom of God. It's Matthew 5, I think it's like 17 or 18. These are the commandments. You do these things. And John's saying, yeah, do these things. So this propitiation, this intervention only works if you change your behavior and do the good things. Imagine for a minute that Moses comes down the mountain and says, what? You have a golden calf? No, bad, bad, bad. Press the golden calf. They say, okay, Moses, we'll stop. We're making a silver one now. What? Right? Well, okay, you don't like gold. How about emerald? Is emerald better? we'll change the material. Well, do you want the calf bigger or short? Was he too fat? We can slim him down some, right? Would that help? No, that would not work. The point is, you can't have a propitiation first come down and fix you and then say, now let's go right back to what we're doing like nothing happened. That's ridiculous. That's absurd. And Moses go right back up, or Jesus go right up. Oh God, yeah, we're done with him. I can't work this. This is non-functional. I agree. This type of thing. Conclude with God on God's side. So that mediator requires the behavior of the individuals to actually change. Which John here, I happen to like how he's wording it. That if you don't follow his commandments, you're lying. If these people, they said, okay, we're gonna stop, and Moses goes back up, and they build a silver calf. What were they doing? They would be lying. That's what they were lying. You'd be a liar. You're doing the same thing you've always done. So the idea is this is pretty simple concept that the mediator requires something of the person that they're mediating for to actually change behavior, to do what God actually asked you to do. So these commandments are important. Moses obviously goes up and gets a new set. This is not like he gets a new set from God in Sinai or on the mountain. But in the same principle, we are responsible. If we're going to have a mediator like Moses or Jesus, We actually have to change and respond in that way to do what the commandments actually said. Do what Moses said. Do what Jesus said. Just do it. It's hard to do sometimes, and we still make our mistakes. But again, if we're not willing to do and willing to make those corrections, the mediation process is a waste, a complete and utter waste. It's wasted on you, wasted on anybody who's not willing to change behavior. I'm not saying you won't have weaknesses. I'm not saying you won't have moments of failure. We're discussing moments for the actual willful choice. I'm willfully choosing to not change. I like what I'm doing, whatever that happens to be, whatever your vice is, whatever God you put in the middle of you, whatever vice it happens to be, I like to keep it that way. Then there really isn't much that God is willing to help you with, or Jesus can help you with. You're not willing to alter your behavior. I'm not saying make yourself, perfect in every way, but I'm saying improve and alter the behavior to follow the commands as best as Jesus and Moses gave. So mediators require that. John points this out pretty bluntly. So if you don't, you're lying. You're just a liar. And what good are you? Because liars don't inherit the kingdom of God. They just don't. There's Timothy. Paul talks to Timothy. He reads the same thing. The idea of a mediator doesn't call him a liar if you fail, but he does. He does pretty similar concepts in Timothy, 1 Timothy chapter 2, and also in Hebrews 9. So we have these mediator requirements to change the inner character or inner worship thing, whatever that happens to be, to insert and remove the pagan item, whatever it is, and however long we had it, doesn't make any difference how long it's been there. Replace it with God as best you can, obviously. And then the mediation process actually works. It's effective. It's functional. So hence, as we started out earlier, first started out today with the artists and the Shabbat, honoring Shabbat, that you have even working on God's behalf, he still expects you to follow his instructions, his rules, his commandments, how he wants things done. It doesn't matter what the story is, whether you're worshiping golden calf over here on the side and say, whoops, you need to stop, or you're worshiping something else you do, whatever happens to be, or whatever you happen to like doing, whatever that thing is that you happen to put in the middle of you, in the middle of your heart, whatever it is, we have a responsibility because God is like, well, he's like us. He's not us, but he made us. He made everything about us. Our emotions, our thought processes, our logical sequences, everything. He made it. He knows what it's like. So it's not like it's shocking for our Father to understand these things. And it is our responsibility to get a functional mediator with Moses to put God, the tabernacle, back where it belongs inside of us in our heart. Both the individual like Aaron, as well as a community, but it includes our nation. I do realize we won't get into this at all, takes amount of time, but I do realize we have examples, which I happen to like Jeremiah's example. He gives quite a few about God saying, okay, Prophet Daniel's a great example. Daniel, you live in a community that has failed to put God center, but I'm going to pluck you out. And not just him, thousands and thousands of people were plucked out of the community, because the individuals, they were still good. Not perfect, but good. They still had God as their center. So as a community, God said, I'm crushing the community as a whole, but I'm individually plucking out in this case, I think it was like hundreds of thousands of people, were pulled out and extracted out to live in Babylon. So God is totally capable of dealing with this exact problem, this issue about having the wrong center of your heart as individuals, out of a community that fails, a community that fails its task of putting God center. God can still be your personal center, and God can pluck you out and put you in a place or a scenario where it's better for you to thrive. May not be what you imagined, what you wanted, whatever, doesn't matter, but the place God can still do that. And it can be in any scenario, any topic matter. Does it make sense? Totally makes sense. I don't lose anybody on these topics for discussion today, but I want to make sure you understood the idea of that golden calf thing with the artists, and artists obviously both, but God was inspiring these people, not devoid of logic, but not using logic as its primary tool, but using their heart as a primary tool, which is where our mercy and forgiveness come from. which he demonstrated with Moses in the intercession thing. That is a primary functional tool that's not used in our Torah logic sequence. It's used in our practical, real life application. If we all follow the Torah strictly without mercy or forgiveness, we'd probably mostly be dead for various mistakes we make, or at least in a lot of pain and misery. If not dead, we'd have a lot of problems. We need the mercy and forgiveness, the heart behind it, to functionally work correctly. And then it inspires us to say, yeah, I'll trash the golden calf. I'll get rid of it, and I'll replace it with God centering me, because the mercy and forgiveness is there. The heart behind it is there.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hillel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions, or if you have any questions, visit the website at hillel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hillel.info.